Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America once again confronts its appetite for fossil fuel as oil spreads across the Gulf of Mexico. U.S. Secretary of Energy and Nobel Prize-winning physicist Stephen Chu has been beating the drum for a price on carbon and rapid development of alternative fuels. But he's also supported offshore drilling and nuclear energy. This hour on Point, as the oil spills, we talk with U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu about getting America to a green energy future. You can join the conversation. What's your vision for getting the U.S. on a green fast track? Why is it taking so long? And what would you put at the top of Secretary Chu's to-do list? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu. He heads a department with nearly 15,000 employees and a 2010 budget of more than $26 billion. The Department of Energy received an additional $36.7 billion in stimulus money in 2009 that it is in the process of distributing. Chu won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1997. He's former director of the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, where he led research into renewable energy. He's a former professor of physics and molecular and cell biology at the University of California. Secretary Chu, Stephen Chu, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Your thoughts as we all watch the oil spread across the Gulf?
Well, it's indeed an unfortunate accident, and the first order of business is to contain that oil spill and to minimize its damage to the coastline. And so that's where we're focused on.
Was it a mistake for the Obama administration, you're part of it, to just, a month ago or so, say, let's look for more opportunities to drill offshore?
No, I don't think it's a mistake. I think the president has always said that we need a balanced portfolio of measures in order to do several things. In a complete energy package, the first and foremost is we want to decrease our dependence on foreign oil. We want to increase our renewables. We need to transition to renewable supplies of energy, especially to bring up our energy efficiency for a lot of goals. These goals range from fundamentally, this is going to be a big boost to our economy. The world will transition to clean energy, and we have an opportunity to lead in that transition.
I know that's your big theme, but I think Americans are looking right now at what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. Arnold Schwarzenegger, governor of California, backing off offshore drilling, which he has not so long ago supported. You've said we're not going to do this in a way that threatens the environment or the coastline. But that's what the president said when he gave a green light for more investigation of offshore drilling a month ago. He said new technologies don't fail on oil rigs. That is manifestly untrue. So, yes, we know the easy line was it has to be part of the package, but is the cost too high?
Well, as I said, this was indeed an unfortunate accident. We're trying to find out what happened. But the other thing to bear in mind is that the multinationals of the world, the ExxonMobils, the BPs, the Chevrons, the Shells, most of their oil reserves are beginning to transition to offshore reserves. And that's just a fact. So accidents do happen. I don't think anyone really says this never can happen, but we have to take stock of what happened, understand what happened, and aggressively put in much better safeguards to lower that probability substantially.
You're a scientist. You know the safeguards that have already been put into effect. I mean, do you really think it can be done? Do you really think we can make this safe enough? I mean, in this case, we don't know yet, but the cost may be, the economy and ecology of the Gulf of Mexico, for heaven's sakes.
Well, whenever things happen, whenever an accident happens, whether something happens, we see this in all cases when there are major earthquakes. We learn a little bit more when there are accidents. We learn a lot more. And so right now there were, as I understand it, this so-called BOP, the blowout prevention valve, had several safeguard redundant features, and apparently they all failed. And so as we work very hard to figure out what happened, first you stop the leak and then figure and do some moratorium. You find out what really happened. So you will have to do some forensic work. And then you go forward. You know, airplanes crash. We find out what happened, and we go forward, and we and every time these truly unfortunate accidents happen, you learn from them.
Accidents happen may sound to some ears a little cavalier here. I know your record, and I know where you are on global warming. I know you don't mean it lightly, but given the extent of the damage, it may sound light. When you were director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, you led a lot of research into renewable energy. A whole lot of that was financed, as I understand it, by BP, a $500 million grant from BP to establish an energy biosciences institute there. Does that influence your view of this particular company and this particular accident?
No, it doesn't. When I say, I hope I didn't sound cavalier when I said, I believe I said this truly unfortunate accident happened and that we have to learn from it. It is something that we want to press towards zero accidents, and this is something that industry does all the time. Things have gotten better. Clearly, because it happened, I would agree, you know, things are not perfect. Things are not fail-safe, and we have to learn from this. Now, we're pausing. We're taking a step, and we have to figure out what really happened. With regard to your question, the grant from BP was on the development of advanced biofuels. This is something where one could use plants that don't compete with food plants, new techniques of breaking down lignocellulose material using agricultural waste like wheat straw, rice straw, to turn that agricultural residue into advanced automobile diesel and jet plane fuels. That's a good thing in my mind, in the sense that the fossil fuel investments in growing the plants and turning them into fuels could be one-fifth, something around that nature of the fuel you get out. So it's a very good thing, I think, that a company like BP was willing to invest a significant amount of money to find an alternative to oil and an alternative that, given our great agricultural resources in the United States, we can actually grow some of the things or put some of the agricultural residues to use that otherwise would be thrown away, would rot, would turn back to carbon dioxide and methane.
That sounds great. That sounds great. But I do wonder, though, now that you're Secretary of Energy, I think a lot of people look out at the world, including the world of energy, maybe in particular, and see the influence of big money all over the place, as people have tried to get legislation. The energy legislation there right now stalled, not making a whole lot of progress. It's described as having many, many compromises in it. I mean, when BP can throw $500 million to your institute, or you know the kind of money that comes to Washington, do you see energy money, whether it's directly influencing the legislative process or whether it's influencing the whole understanding of global warming, as having slowed down progress toward green energy?
Well, it depends on the companies in question. I think there are progressive companies that recognize the threat of climate change. They need to do something about it. I believe that BP and Shell were the first two major oil companies that perhaps 10, 12 years ago, said there is a real risk of climate change. In the minds of the two CEOs that I heard speaking about that, they said, we've got to, there's no doubt in their mind that the climate was changing, that is a very high probability that a lot of that was caused by humans, and we've got to do something about it. So I think progressive companies have begun to show leadership in this respect. And we say we need something. We need to cap our emission of carbons worldwide and ratchet it down.
I mean, BP even adopted the branding, the marketing slogan for itself, Beyond Petroleum. But that's petroleum in the Gulf of Mexico right now, and lots of it.
Right. Well, it will take time to make this transition. I, as you well know, I'm a big believer in cleaner sources of energy, renewable wind, solar. Nuclear energy has to be part of the mix as well, and we have to diversify our energy supply 80+% 85% of our energy comes from fossil fuel at this moment. And in order to make our climate goals of decreasing our carbon emissions by 80% by mid-century, which is ambitious, but it's doable, but we've got to work very hard in doing this now. You've got to move as aggressively as you can. Now, having said that, you can't instantly turn on renewables in one or two decades. You turn on as quickly as you can, but we need to also develop our transmission and distribution lines. We need to develop ways of allocating the energy, storing the energy, and we, quite frankly, have to begin rebuilding our nuclear fleet as well.
You've been in Washington for more than a year now. That's a small piece of a half-century major turn. But what's your sense at the speed at which the United States is moving on energy policy? What's actually happening as opposed to what you think should be happening?
Well, but starting with the Recovery Act, there have been major investments in energy. The president has made a pledge to double, for example, the renewable energy in the next 3 or 4 years. We are on track to do that. I would say near term would be 2025. There are projections we think we might be able to get to 25% wind. Solar, the prices of solar are coming down. It's becoming competitive on certain, you know, hot areas, rooftop applications where the price of electricity depends on the time of day. But I have hopes that the price of photovoltaics also will be coming down.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with U.S. Energy Secretary and Nobel Prize winner Stephen Chu about the oil spill in the Gulf and the country's push to get beyond fossil fuels. If anything made the need for that clear, the oil spill in the Gulf surely has. Here's Paul Nelson. His family has fished off Alabama's coast for generations. They were hit by Hurricane Katrina. He told NPR's Debbie Elliott he's now worried about losing much more.
This is going to set us back, and like I said, our way of life. If this does what we as commercial fishermen look at and think it can do, it can destroy us for the next 50 years.
For the next 50 years, just in the Gulf of Mexico, Stephen Chu has described big destruction that could come with climate change, not just there, but all over. Mr. Secretary, lots of questions for you. Here's Katie in Norton, Massachusetts. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question for the Energy Secretary, it sounds like he has a plan for the next 50 years or the next century, but how many disasters will it take for us to finally completely cut our reliance on fossil fuels?
How many disasters and how much time, Mr. Secretary?
That's very hard to answer. I think tragedies, disasters like the one we're talking about really have one, give one pause, and you've got to reconsider what's going on. I think, like you, would like nothing more to transition away from fossil fuels as quickly as possible. If we don't do that, there are things that our children and grandchildren will suffer. Also, as you well know, the United States is putting out roughly a $1 billion a day to import oil, and this is money that goes offshore. So there are many reasons why you want to decrease the amount of fossil fuel, particularly transportation fuel, in many ways, which everybody can contribute to. I think by driving more fuel efficient cars as a beginning. But as I said, this tragedy that occurred is something that is giving us pause. But let's take it one step at a time. Let's figure out what happened. Is this something that we have to deal with, once a century or once? If it comes quite often, we have to really rethink what's going on. I would have to say.
Of course, if the consequences are decades in the making, I don't know if you can tolerate it at all. Tom Friedman writes in the New York Times today, and I want to get your thoughts. He says, we have to stop messing around with idiotic drill baby drill nostrums, feel good, Earth Day concerts, and the paralyzing notion that the American people are not prepared to do anything serious to change our energy mix. And he's really pointing there to a price on carbon, which opponents are quick to call, you know, a gas tax. You've talked a lot about a price on carbon. Are we getting closer to having it? Do we need it to change at the speed that's required, Secretary?
Well, I think we have to look at what we're doing and in terms of our transportation fuel. And there are many ways to tackle this. The first thing, as I went back and stressed, we have to transition to cars that are much more fuel efficient. We need to look at advanced biofuels so that we can offload oil for things that we can grow onshore that don't compete with food. We want to try to electrify our personal vehicle fleet, especially ones where, you know, typically you drive 50 or less miles a day. And applications like that, I think within 5 years, we will have the batteries that can begin to be introduced in mass production, to mass adoption, batteries that could last 15 years, a lifetime of a car, that could allow you to have plug-in hybrids. So all these are steps that take us away from first transportation fuel, and then secondly, when you charge your car with electricity, there are many more options for generating the electricity in a clean way, or even if we use fossil fuel in those instances, we can capture the carbon. So we will be given many more options to clean up our energy supply.
The vision is good and the language sounds right, but I have a feeling that Americans have dialed into this problem in a fresh way in the last couple of weeks and are really wondering about the pace. And you speak generally about it, but this isn't a matter of generalities. As you well know, Mr. Secretary, there's been the energy bill passed last summer in the House, gone nowhere, supposed to be rolled out in the Senate, gone nowhere yet. I mean, and you're describing, you know, a matter of just a few years in which we have time to address this effectively. So I kind of ask again, where you look specifically about pace, and do you see us really on track to keep from the kind of climate change nightmares that you've described very explicitly?
Well, I think we need to pass a strong, comprehensive energy bill. This energy bill will have to include things that would stimulate the growth of clean energy, whether it's environmentally sustainable hydro, wind, solar, nuclear energy. I think this bill has to encourage the investments in those technologies. It's very important that a bill encourage investments in those technologies because the world is making this transition. If we don't invent those technologies, someone else will. And so it's not only to clean up our environment, it's not only to decrease our dependence on fossil fuel, but this is a big thing economically. Energy reaches into every sector of the United States, and we can lead in the transition to essentially what's going to be required is a new industrial revolution. How do you get the energy we want and need, but in a clean way? China is moving. Europe is moving. Japan and Korea are moving. They're moving very fast. They see that as the future world, just as everybody sees in the coming decades that the price of oil will be higher because of supply and demand. So these are things that we need in a clean energy bill. We need a price on carbon. That price on carbon sets, you know, the price can kick in after we're out of the recession in a couple of years, but the price has to be there, and it has to ratchet in a way that gives people who have to make decisions on what type of power plant to build. This is a 50, 60-year investment. They can build a coal plant with carbon capture sequestration, or they can transition to gas. Eventually, we're going to have to capture the carbon from the gas plant, or they can build a nuclear plant. How much can they? We will build wind and solar when it becomes cost-effective as quickly as possible, but that takes a while to scale up. So all of these things have to be put in play.
Do you think that the Kerry Graham Lieberman bill, which we haven't even fully seen yet, it got stalled in the immigration flap a couple of weeks ago, you say we need a strong, comprehensive energy bill. Does this bill constitute a strong, comprehensive energy bill?
Well, I haven't seen the details of it, but I applaud the effort of those three. I think what is important is you've got to start somewhere. And again, I don't see the details. The most obvious place to start is in the electricity generation sector. You need some pressure whether it's higher EPA mileage standards, a tailpipe, carbon dioxide things, something on the transportation sector. And eventually, we're going to have to capture the other stationary sources, for example, the production of steel and cement. But one could start with the power sector. You know, would I like to see it all done this year? Yes. But if it meant we don't get anything, I'd rather see parts of it get going. Once we get moving, this is shown time and time again, once we start moving, then engineers and scientists begin to really solve the problem, because we know if we know where we want to be 20, 30, 50 years from today, people who have to make billion-dollar investments are saying, okay, now we know the path. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out technologically. And you know, quite frankly, the experience we've had, if you think about the Clean Air Act in the early 1990s, when we said a quarter of the Northeast lakes and rivers were dying from acid rain, that we have to stop emitting the SOx and NOx from our power plants. They said the initial estimates of the EPA, for example, were quite high. And now what's happening is that was the cap and trade system, and the trading of allocations for SOx and NOx emissions are about one-tenth what the initial EPA estimates were. And believe me, the EPA wasn't trying to highball these estimates. They were trying to give as accurate an estimate as possible.
But how far do you think the Kerry, Graham, Lieberman bill gets us? Does it get us 10% of the way to where you think we ought to be at this point to get on track for the kind of reductions required? 5%, 1%, halfway?
Oh, that's really hard to say because, as you know, I haven't seen the whole thing. You have, you know, mm-hmm. It hasn't been unveiled.
But everybody knows there are a ton of compromises in it. It's very far from a flat carbon tax.
That's correct. But again, I will go back to what I've said before. You get the process going. You start the United States going in this direction. And what you need are, what's very important are some of these long-term signals, like put a cap on carbon, and it's going to have to, and that cap has to come down.
But when that cap has so many provisos in it, do you think Kerry, Graham, Lieberman is enough to get the avalanche of investment money unleashed that you and others have talked about to push the U.S. quickly down this road? Is it enough or not?
Well, if I were, I care about this very deeply, and I think the best way to do it is get it going. If we wait for the perfect bill to emerge, it may not emerge for 5 years. It may not even emerge for longer periods of time. The reason I say get it going now is because once you get it going and the technology begins to be developed at a much faster pace, because all of a sudden, at least in a particular sector, you know this is for real, then people can take a breath and say, okay, it's not so bad. I talked about the cost of SOx and NOx, mm-hmm. Now the training being one-tenth the price. You look at, I'll pick up another thing, catalytic converters. When they were first being introduced, they were said, oh, these catalytic converters, the estimates were $2,700, $2,000 to put a catalytic converter on a car. I Googled how much it would cost to buy a catalytic converter today. It's about $200 retail. And so all I'm saying is when we are going in the right direction over a period of time, the technology, the manufacturing processes, all these things get very good. And this is, again, a great testament to American ingenuity.
But there's an issue of pace here that you've already pointed out, both economically, others pushing ahead much more quickly, and ecologically, and we see that right now in the Gulf. I mean, this may be a moment when Americans are willing to change pace, or maybe you think they aren't. Maybe you think Americans won't. You accept the political idea that Americans won't accept a real price on carbon.
Well, I think I'm more optimistic than that. I think Americans, once they realize that this is their economic future at stake, this is not. I think it. You know, for those who don't want it to happen, say, "Oh, this is an additional tax. It's, you know, makes our energy prices higher, things of that nature." But we're not talking about doubling energy prices. We're not even talking about increases of 50%. No, if you're talking about a very small percentage increase in a way that gets things going, just as this, you know, the price of cars did not go up by $2,000 when we put catalytic converters on the cars. The price of electricity did not go up by 20%. It was probably not noticeable to most people. when we started scrubbing the SOx and NOx out of the plants. And now our rivers and lakes are recovering. So I think the issue here is get it going. Technology improves. I feel very strongly that the cost will not be as much as what people are saying. In fact, some of the estimates I'm saying I know are just not going to be right, because we're looking at some of these technologies and we have our own cost estimates, and they're substantially lower. But that's with today's technology. And we're talking about technologies. For example, I'm seeing great developments in batteries. There are...
In what country?
In the U.S. I mean, I'm talking about research in batteries. I'm seeing a wonderful set of ideas. I see a whole lot of truly talented people, scientists and engineers, jumping into this area and saying, this is such an important problem. It's so tied to the prosperity of the United States. It's so tied to doing the environmentally right thing, that as a scientist, and this is the way I felt, that's why I left my job at Stanford. I said, this is too important a problem.
Mr. Secretary, I come back to the issue of pace. Is your president leading enough on this? Is he pushing hard enough to get the country on track to be economically successful, ecologically successful?
Believe me, the president not only shares these views, he is a leader in these views. He is pushing as hard as he can in order to get this stuff done. I mean, Washington is a complicated place. I've been living here a year and a quarter, and it's complicated. But don't for a moment doubt that the president shares these views.
Why not the Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington State bill that just puts a cap on, makes energy companies bid for their energy every year, raises, you know, puts the price on carbon right there. Yes, that would raise the price of gas and all kinds of energy, but then they'd cut a check to Americans and distribute that money back to people to offset that higher price. But you'd have the effect of the price on carbon to get other things going. Why not that way?
I think, you know, mechanisms like that all should be considered. We do want to put a price on carbon. We want to give the American consumer, this is, I don't really see this as a tax per se. I would like to give a substantial part of it back, either as giving back in some form to offload, especially in the poorer sections of the United States, those sections that you have to give Americans time to make a transition, 10-plus years. So when you set these goals, you know, you can give America time to make that transition. During the time you're making that transition, you help them insulate their homes to make them more energy efficient so that the energy bills don't go up. This is what California did, for example. It when it transitioned to cleaner supplies of energy after the first of the oil shocks in the mid-70s, it went, both parties in the state of California said, we're going to push energy efficiency, we're going to make our energy cleaner, we're going to do all these things. And although the average rate of electricity in California went up higher than the national average, the average energy bill did not go up as high. It was substantially lower. It was, in fact, one of the lowest. And the reason was the amount of electricity the average Californian used remained constant for the next 30 years.
Now the clock's ticking for the whole country. I mean, I hear your vision. I just really wonder about pace, and especially wonder when we're looking at this situation in the Gulf of Mexico. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu is with us today. Mr. Secretary, please stand by. We've got lots of callers for you here. We will go to them right after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. We're talking this hour with U.S. Energy Secretary and Nobel Prize winner Stephen Chu about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and the country's push to get beyond fossil fuel. Secretary Chu, I don't want to go too quickly past your big picture on climate change itself. I'm looking here at a story quoting you in the LA Times last year, saying that by the end of this century, we could see such dire consequences. California farms and vineyards vanished. The Sierra snowpack disappeared. Major cities in California in big jeopardy, and never mind water shortages in the West and upper Midwest. You said then, I don't think the American public has gripped in its gut what could happen. What could happen? How's your view unfolded in the last year, and do you think Americans see it now?
No, I think there's still a problem. What I was talking about, to give the full nuance to that, is I was talking about a paper that came out of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a very distinguished scientific journal, and it gave two scenarios. One would be a low-emission scenario, where we aggressively try to do something about the carbon emission in the world, and business-as-usual high-emission scenario. And the thing you were quoting was in this high-emission scenario, where the snowpack, the water supply, the alpine forest in California were at great risk. And this is a serious issue. Now, what's the probability that this is going to come true? Well, when you start to make regional predictions of climate, there are uncertainties. It's much easier to make a world average prediction. But even if you take the possibility this could be a 50% chance of happening, you've got to do something about it. It's just prudent.
And we're on that high emissions path now, are we not?
We are. Well, apart from the recession, yes, we are. I would say we're still on a high emissions pathway. And this is why it is so important for Congress to pass a comprehensive energy bill. But I go back to this. This is not only for the environmental reasons, but it is also for economic reasons, because the world, China now says, their leadership in China says, climate change to China and the rest of the world is going to be unsustainable. Our China's carbon emission growth is unsustainable. We're going to diversify energy supply. We're going to do something about it. But because the world is going to need all this technology, we, China, see an opportunity to be the leaders in the development of this technology. So it's
you've said they're grabbing.
They're
grabbing an industrial revolution that we perhaps are not.
That's my fear, and so here we are, the country with the greatest research and development and innovation machine in the world, bar none. If it gets the right signals, we can lead in this new industrial revolution. The point here I'm making is, let's make a reasonable assumption about what the world will be 20 and 50 years from today. And a reasonable assumption is that the price of oil will be higher because of supply and demand issues, because we have to go to more remote places of more unconventional oil, more offshore oil, more offshore expensive oil, because we're going to have to extract this very safely. And so all these things, plus the demand, especially the rising economies of developing countries like China and India and others, will create a higher demand in transportation fuel. So you can make – it's a safe bet. You can't take – the fluctuation of oil could continue, but on average, 20, 50 years from today, it will be higher. The other safe bet is that the evidence of climate change and what it could do is growing stronger every day. And year by year, people are saying, this is – what, 20 years ago, we weren't for sure certain about it, 30 years ago, that has rapidly changed. And the debate is not whether the climate is changing or whether humans have had a major say in this. It's going to very nuanced things about what it's going to do. There are still unknowns, but again, just take this. You don't have to be 90 or 95% sure that some of these bad things can happen. If you say, even if there's a 50% chance that these very bad things could happen, you have to do something about it.
Let's go to Richard, calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Richard, you're on with Energy Secretary Stephen Chu.
Thank you. I have great respect for Energy Secretary Chu. I've been following what he's been saying publicly, and I really appreciate it. I do want to know, though, why the president does not come out and tell the American people about what Jim Hansen calls the coming climate catastrophe. I mean, right now we're moving to 5 to 7 degrees Celsius, and for each degree Celsius, we have a 10% reduction in crop yields. That's known in the science. We're already in the process of these ice sheets are starting to disintegrate. That means we lose our coastal cities, and we're asleep, and the American people don't know about it. You've had this climate gate, all this nonsense about the scientists. Not somehow.
The emails, yep.
Yeah, the emails, and that was all shown to be nonsense, that the scientists weren't involved in some grand conspiracy, and the public's confused. The president needs to come out and tell the truth, the real truth, not this wishy-washy, everything's going to be okay. And I know that John Schellenhuber at the German Advisory Council evidently has spoken with Secretary Chu and basically showed him the carbon budget approach, that if we don't have major reductions by 2020, we make it nearly impossible to meet the 2050 targets. So why don't we tell the truth on this? Why doesn't the president tell the truth on that? And let's speak honestly what we're dealing with.
Secretary Chu.
Well, I think the president has, but the other thing, what we're trying to do also is there are two ways to motivate people. I think both work for me. One way is to worry about the consequences. That's how I got into this. But the other thing is to recognize the economic opportunity, and not only the economic opportunity, but to recognize it's an economic imperative. It's both an opportunity, a great opportunity to do something that will fuel our future prosperity for the coming century. But if we don't, then we will be importing all the technologies that the other countries who have this vision of the future that I share and that the president shares. And so that's why I think it's very important to get started this year, not 2 years from today or a year or 3 years or 5 years or something, because it will take time and it will be a race who will develop the technologies that we will need to have a sustainable energy future.
I have a sense that the American people may be way ahead of Washington at this point, at least a lot of them. I mean, looking at the response we're getting, here's Gail, Mr. Secretary. This is on Facebook. She says, the lethargy is so disheartening. Obama has a chance to make sweeping change now. The people will rally behind a united effort to get the country off the oil teat. I say let the weaning begin today. That's from Gail. And here's from another poster on the web, says, okay, Mr. Chu, using your example of the catalytic converter, which you mentioned, propose a rule that all new homes must have solar panels installed. There you go. Now we're talking. Also, all current homes owned by banks cannot be resold until they've been weatherized. There you go. Write it up. You hear that kind of let's go right now, Mr. Secretary, please.
Okay, so here's what we're trying to do. We are tough. We want, you know, the install first. Before we do solar panels, let's start with blocking and tackling. That's the fundamentals. And you can do so much to a home, a new home or an older home, by retrofitting, putting in more insulation, replacing leaky doors and windows, or sealing them up. Every home I bought, I've done this except one, which was new construction, and it was done to California standards.
So how about a catalytic-style requirement right now?
Well, we are... We're working with Sean Donovan at HUD so that we can, when homes change, that we are going to make it much easier when you get a structural inspection, that you get an energy audit inspection. We're trying to make it much easier so that you can tack on to the mortgage a little bit extra to get $5,000, $10,000 that you can invest in the house to make it much more energy efficient. We believe that the added amount per mortgage will be less than the money you save on a yearly basis and decrease energy bills. These are things that we want to push as hard as possible. The states are responsible and local communities are responsible for insulation standards, but I am pushing them as hard as possible to up those insulation standards, because that's real money making that can pay for itself in 1 or 2 years, according to, for example, a McKinsey study.
Mm. Let's go to Madison, Wisconsin, and Bob, you're on the air with Secretary Chu.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Secretary. I'm a farmer and have no doubt that there are hundreds of thousands of farms in the United States like mine where we would like to get off the public grid. And it's very exorbitant to be able to do that now. So I'm suggesting that the government at least give us very low interest or no interest loans, where we could pay them back with the surplus energy we can produce. But there's no reason why every farm in the United States can't produce its own energy plus surplus energy to use in the neighborhood. And I don't want something for nothing. I will pay back what it costs to install that type of equipment, but I would like some help now, and it's nearly impossible, and very exorbitant to do that.
Secretary Chu, help farmers put solar panels on their farms and get off the grid. What do you say?
Well, I think this is one of these very happy moments that in order to transition to sustainable energy, this is going to be very good for rural America in many ways. We can give, not only can you grow the food that the world needs, but using, again, on not your prime land, but on other land, you can grow grasses without huge inputs of fertilizer and tillage, perennials that can be used to create a new class of biofuels. The residues, if you grow wheat, for example, all that wheat straw that is used for bedding material now, you can take a large fraction of that. And we are developing processes, which I quite frankly know will, are going to be piloted within a couple of years, so that you can create substitutes for gasoline, diesel, and jet plane fuel.
What about Bob's specific question on a subsidy for solar?
Right. Well, I think it doesn't have to be solar per se. I think with you, when you have farmland, you also have you have wind access, you have biomass access. All of those things can be used to produce energy. And to get the farms to be net producers of energy is something I think I'm very supportive of, quite frankly. And it's I think the question was, is a matter of how to help farmers and cooperatives to actually get those investments needed mm-hmm. to overcome that capital hurdle
right.
so that they can be net producers of energy for the United States. And we do look at these. We Farm of Energy does pilot these things, but I think the question is a very good one. I think we have to look at mechanisms for financing that could be self-sustaining, that in the end it's not taxpayer money, but we help them overcome the financial hurdle. They produce net energy. They sell it. It's good for everybody.
Yep. Bob, thanks very much for your call. Here's a question from the web, Mr. Secretary. It says, does the oil spill in the Gulf have implications for nuclear's future expansion in the U.S.? France has obviously shown it can be effective, but are there still the same low-probability, high-impact consequences associated with nuclear that come with drilling for oil a mile beneath the ocean surface? You've pushed for more nuclear. What about the risks that come with it?
Well, here again, I think we want very much to restart the nuclear industry. The nuclear reactors today, we believe, are far safer than the ones that were built 20 and 30 years ago. The really old-style reactors, for example, the Chernobyl style, we have helped. Russia's been very good about this, and all of those types that really have been, no, they have a weakness. Those things are being shut down. So, but nevertheless, what we are driving for in nuclear reactors is something that is passively safe. And by passively safe, I mean you'd lose, you know, your electrical systems break down in a nuclear power plant. And can you design a nuclear reactor that essentially will never melt down? And we are working towards those designs now. And so right now, the first hurdle is the last nuclear reactors that were built in the United States took a long time to get approved and built. That long time of building and improving meant that you had a lot of invested capital mm-hmm. that was not generating revenues. And so the first issue is, can we build this new generation of very safe reactors on time, on schedule, on budget? If you can, the economics look very good. And this is why we started a loan guarantee program with the intent of helping industry in the first 6, 7, 8 reactors with a guarantee that is self-financed. It's meaning that the U.S. government backs it up, but we have to convince the OMB that this loan and effectively a loan insurance, a credit subsidy that's paid for by the company that wants to build the reactor, doesn't cost the taxpayer any money.
One more call for the Secretary. Rob in Milton, Massachusetts. Rob, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking the call.
Our time is short, Rob, so go straight to it.
Yes, I'm listening here, and I get the sense that Professor Chu, Secretary Chu, it's not just that he believes these things, he knows these things, and that the science is there. It's not his fault that he's in part beholden to the administration. I voted for Obama. I vote for him again. But maybe this is a time where maybe we get out of campaign mode, do what we know is possible, put the gas tax in place. Americans' need for an SUV will go away. They'll drive what they have to, and you know, make the hard decisions now and make a place for America in this future of new energy.
Rob, let us pick it up. Secretary Chu, we've just got a minute. Do you envy China sometimes? It's not a democracy. They just order it from Beijing. Do you wish you had that power? Can a democracy do this in time?
I'd rather be living in the United States than China, no question about it. I think, you know, we have a political process. That political process is part of our democracy, part of our freedom. Sometimes you have to work your way through it. But on the other hand, I will go back to what I said before. Once the United States decides to do something and once the policies are written and determined, we can and have moved faster than any other country in the world. And so if you ask where I'd like to live, I like it just fine here. You have to work through political processes, and in the end you have to convince the American people this is the right thing to do. This is the right thing to do for their future prosperity.
Well, we're waiting, and we wish you luck. Stephen Chu, Secretary of Energy, thanks very much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.